So I thought that since Srila Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati has of course Srila Prabhupada is our founder Acharya, and it is his faithful following of his Gurudev which has given us the Hare Krishna movement as it is. But a lot of the things that we take for granted in the Hare Krishna movement came actually from Srila Bhakti Siddhanta's research and his compassion and his organizational skills. When you combine compassion and organizational skills, it's a good mixture. Usually if you get a bloke who's good at organizational skills, that's interesting, but it's not really relevant. And if you have someone who's compassionate but can't manage his way out of a paper bag, that's interesting, but may not be effective. When you get these two skills coming together, then you've got a very powerful combination. But to say that Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati only had these two skills is to not give him any praise at all, because there are many people who are compassionate and they're good organizers. They open hospitals, or they open places for refuge, or they join the United Nations and they feed people. But when you have a pure devotee of Krishna, who's the very embodiment of the teachings of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, and then you combine it with organization, and then you combine it with compassion, then you start to have some, you know, now we're talking. But these prayers, they talk about the salient features of his qualities. Normally what happens is that after the guru has been preaching for some time, the followers come together and they put together a pranam mantra which incorporates the different features of his contribution. So the first one, is known to us because Prabhupada's pranams. It's sort of a generic pranam, and it's a generic pranam because we use it for all teachers in this Krishna consciousness movement. It simply says that Krishna Prashta, you're very dear to Krishna. So that's the first quality of someone that you're looking for in a spiritual teacher, that somehow or another he or she has done something in their life to become dear to Krishna. And if you look in the Bhagavad Gita, you'll find that these are the qualities of a person who is dear to Krishna. So it's a very simple mantra. It doesn't describe anything in particular, other than one particular follower describes you as being dear to Krishna. That's good. If you're not dear to Krishna, then how can you teach something that will endear them to Krishna? Or one of the first qualities is to know how to become dear to Krishna, to teach how to become dear to Krishna, to be dear to Krishna, and to help one's disciples also to gain the affections of Krishna. And this is the principle of the Guru. He says, "My dear Lord Krishna, if I've done anything to please you, will you please give your mercy to such and such?" Right, to Bhakta such and such, this person. So this is Krishna Prashta. Then the next quality is having taken shelter of Krishna. To take shelter of Krishna means to exhibit the six qualities of Sharanagati. The Sharanagata devotee exhibits the six qualities of having taken shelter of Krishna. He's always thinking how to serve Krishna. He thinks that Krishna is his protector, his only shelter. He sees Krishna as his only refuge. And in that way he takes shelter. That anything that I want in my life is going to come from Krishna, directly or indirectly. That doesn't mean that Krishna appears before you playing his flute with the winning lottery numbers. But it means that Krishna, normally through the agency of his devotees, will make arrangements for everything that you've ever dreamed of and more. Krishna will give you the dreams. He'll help you to understand. That was someone's preaching line to me when I was about 17. I said, well, on the one hand, I'd like to come to your movement. I'd like to join your movement. But on the other hand, you know, I've got school to go back to. I was in the sixth form at school. Well, if it was today, someone would say, oh, well, you can come on our sabbatical, and then you can do university. And then we'll hope to get you back at the end of all that. I don't think so. But at that age, they said, no, you have to join the movement. And I said, why do I have to join? Because it's the only thing that you can do with your life. Now, faced with that sort of preaching, what was a young 17-year-old supposed to do? I said, but I want to travel. I want to see the world. I like art. I like music. I want to, you know, there's a lot of other things. And they said, yeah, you can do all that. And you can do it in Krishna consciousness. You can do it for Krishna. I said, really? Yeah, sure. And then the devotee told me the killer line. He told me the killer line. He said, you know, I've studied your qualities very carefully. And I thought, this is interesting. This is me, 17-year-old, okay? I've studied your qualities very carefully, and I think you're a unique individual. Yeah? 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 Of course, he was right. I had to believe him, didn't I? I'm a unique individual. God didn't make two of me. He was far more intelligent than that. But he said, here comes the killer line. He said, you know, I really think within the next 5 years, you could become a sannyasi. He was so wrong. He was so wrong. But within the next 5 years, I said, really? Do you mean that? And he said, oh yeah, definitely. And so that was it. I was in. I was hooked. What was my point? Krishna will fulfill all your desires. So, yes. So he said, I said, I want to travel. Have I traveled? I've never stopped traveling. Well, all right, maybe a little while. But I never stopped traveling. I came here for 3 days. And then they said, would you like to go traveling? And I said, yeah, of course. Of course. And I said, thank you, Krishna. Krishna must be real. He's fulfilling all my desires already. This is desperately uncomfortable, this chair. You should have another little bit in front. So I never stopped traveling for 6 years, and then it was India, and then it was Africa, and then it was, you know, America, and then it was so many different places. So I fulfilled all my desires. Everything I have wanted to do, that I would have wanted to do in life, has been fulfilled. And the only payment that I had to make, in most cases, was to wear a silly bedsheet for most of my life and have cold legs, a cold head, having shaved my head, and to every day when I get up, chant, Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. But let me tell you, it has all been worth it. It's wonderful. So you're never the loser. So having taken shelter of Krishna and given everything up, don't think that you're losing everything. That's, I guess, my message there. So taking refuge of Krishna, Shri Krishna Sharanam Mama. One particular sampradaya says, Shri Krishna Sharanam Mama. I take shelter of Krishna. Lord Krishna is my only shelter. And so don't think that Krishna is poor and he doesn't know what you need. So life is a long, you know, we always say life is short, but at some times in your life it appears to be quite long. And to make it from one end to the other in Krishna consciousness requires that you have the long distance vision. When I was a boy, I had above average lung capacity, which makes you good for leading kirtan sometimes, but it also makes you good for long distance running. So I was a long-distance runner, and I ran for the county. And long-distance runner means you can't be interested in a sprint. That's the point. That Krishna consciousness is not a 100-yard sprint. It's not a, 100-meter sprint. It's not a 200-meter. It's not a 400-meter, you see. It's even longer than a marathon. Marathon you can do in a few hours. But this is a whole lifetime endeavor. So we set ourselves up for the lifetime by doing a lot of deep breathing in the beginning, This is pranayama. You fill your lung capacity until your lungs are practically breaking, and then you have enough. These people who hold their breath for 5 minutes when they go fishing in the water, they go deep underwater and they can go fishing for 5 minutes. But they practice deep breathing exercises. Now, I'm only using this as an analogy. We don't practice deep breathing in our Krishna consciousness movement. But in one sense, we do. Pranayama means to control the breath also with mantra. So for 2 hours a day, we practice pranayama. We practice breath control. We practice speech control. You see? We're cultivating the intelligence through Bhagavatam classes. We're going deeper and deeper and deeper. And then we can go the distance. So a lot of what we hear from Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati and Srila Prabhupada is how to go deep first so that you can, to use another analogy, build your skyscraper as high as possible. They're building a huge skyscraper in London now. It's going to be the tallest building in London, called the Shard. I went to a meeting the other day and got dropped off at London Bridge train station. And from London Bridge train station, you can look over and you can see the Shard. It's really big. But in order to make it that big, they had to go really, really deep on the foundations first. And at some point, you know, a skeptic would have come and they would have looked and said, "What on earth are you going in that direction for, going downwards? You're going so far down, you're meant to be building the tallest building in London. That's the other direction." So an intelligent person would know that the taller the building you require, the deeper the foundations. So a lot of what we see from Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati is foundation building. He only had 18 sannyasis, which isn't much compared to the 100 or so we have in our Krishna consciousness movement now. But to get 100 sannyasis, you have to really make sure that the 18 that you train are very good. You have to start with a very pure but small organization before you can have a very big organization. Now, in a very big organization, you have lots of mixed type of devotees. Some of the people in the, you will be surprised to hear this, some of the people in the groups that were affiliated to the what became known as the Gaudiya Math, we find that sometimes these villagers eat fish, but they chant Hare Krishna mantra. Now you can say, "Oh, how come they're in Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati's movement?" But the point is that technically they're not, but technically they are, because if you chant Hare Krishna in Bengal or what is now called Bangladesh, there's a good chance that in some way your grandmother or your grandfather's life was touched by Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati. So to have a very big movement which encourages people to chant Hare Krishna means that around the periphery you're going to have people that don't follow all the rules. But they're also part of this expansion. But it means in order to have those people at the periphery, you've also got to, which we want, compassion means that you pick up people, you know, being a lifeguard means that you pick up people even if they punch you in the face. My brother works in a home for people who are disabled, and sometimes he comes back with punches, scratches, bruises to his thighs where he's been kicked. But it's not that he comes home and he says, "Right, I'm never going to that place again. Do you know what they did today? They kicked me. They punched me. They did all these things." No, because he's a compassionate person. And it means that you go to work expecting people not to be ladies and gentlemen. In a desperate condition, some of them. So he gets kicked and punched, but he keeps coming back for more. So really, you could say that compassion at some stage involves people kicking and punching. And this is one feature that we'll see from Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati's life. Now, let us move on. He is known as Varshabhanavi Devi Dayita Das. This was one of his initiated names, which means the servant of the lover of Sri Radharani. So that Varshabhanavi Devi Dayita Das, it's a long name. I thought only Jayapataka Maharaj gave out the triple-barreled names, but And your name is Varshabhanavi Devi Dayita Das. Thank you, Guru Maharaj. That means that every form I have to fill in, every conversation, every time someone says, what's your spiritual name? Oh, it's Varshabhanavi Devi Dayita Das. Okay. Is it okay if I call you Varsh? Which is what we do, isn't it? We shorten names. Everything gets shortened in time. So before you shorten things, at least understand what the long one is. So it says, this verse also says that he's favored by Srimati Radharani. At one time he said, actually, we're not devotees of Krishna. He said, we're not devotees of Krishna. That's too presumptuous. We're devotees of Radharani. One time he was at Radhakund, which is the lake of Radha in Vrindavan. And there was a small-time king who would come there with his followers. And he said that, he said, the king has come to Radha's lake because he is a worshipper of Krishna. He said, we have come to Radha's lake because we are worshippers of Radharani. He said, by Radharani's mercy, we are allowed to worship Krishna. And this is something esoteric for those of you who wondered when Kripamoya would start with the esoteric stuff. He said, those who are not related to Krishna in a conjugal mood, he said, their param 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 guru is Lord Nityananda Prabhu. And those who are intimately related with Krishna in Madhurya Ras, their guru, original guru, Adi Guru, is Srimati Radharani. Okay? That's for those of you who are expecting me to say something esoteric. Now I'll move on. It says here that he's the ocean of transcendental mercy. Sometimes we may think that these are just sort of epithets. Epithet is something, is a name that you give someone based on one of their qualities. We may think that this is just, you know, flowery words. Sometimes in front of your guru, you don't speak the truth. You see, the guru asks for the truth so that he can deal with you as you need to be dealt with. But sometimes we don't speak the truth. We say, yes, yes, Guruji, yes, Guru Maharaj. Yeah, you're, you know, and then you stand up to give a Vyasa Puja offering and it's very flowery. Your rose petal toes, your lotus petal eyes, your affectionate sidelong glance. You have saved me from the ocean. We're good on oceans in our movement, you know, ocean of mercy. You know, what is it? You've saved me from the ocean of samsara by your glance, which is like the ocean of mercy. Well, make your mind up, you know. Use one analogy in one sentence. Otherwise, it becomes confusing. So in here it said he's the ocean of mercy. But in fact, he was the ocean of mercy because he took so much pain upon himself. If you're trying to start a popular movement, if you want to be popular and you want people to join your movement, don't say the things that Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati said. You see? Sometimes we think, how can I preach if I don't say things which people are going to find popular? So we become accommodated to modern political views, modern spiritual views, etc., etc. But he never became accommodated to anything or anyone. He was just resolute in his determination to give the teachings of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, and we are so lucky that he did, because had he not done so, the Krishna consciousness movement would really have stopped with Bhaktivinoda Thakur. I'm going to read you out a letter that Bhaktivinoda Thakur wrote to his son, Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati, asking him to keep the movement going, to keep the movement that he had started going. And this letter is a very pivotal letter for us, because it's just like the letters that Prabhupada used to send, you know, please keep the movement going. And it's letters like that that you will get from your spiritual master, which says, please keep the movement going. Please contribute to the movement. I know what I wanted to say. I wanted to tell you about the apple analogy. If you pick up an apple, which part do you look forward to eating? Okay, you can take that as a rhetorical question. The skin by itself is not so helpful, but it's the sweet apple that we want. But no one really, really, unless they're strange, would disregard the sweet apple and go directly for the core. The core of an apple is the very opposite of the apple itself. The apple fruit is sweet, but the seeds and the core are bitter. Pips are bitter. You ever eaten apple pips? Very bitter. The fruit of the apple is juicy. The core isn't. You get the imagery. So sometimes when we look to the fruit of someone's preaching, but we look at the core, you may think this is not very interesting at all. And sometimes people like to make this distinction. And it's this distinction you really have to be careful not to make. Sometimes people look at a spiritual organization, such as ours, and they say, well, I love the movement, which is all about, you know, a family of spiritual practitioners, but I don't like the institution. And notice the two words that they use. One is movement, and one is institution. And we make this discrimination normally because one thing we like, and the other thing we don't like. Well, I like the apple, but I don't like the core. Well, okay, we should just eat the core, eat the apple. But understand that there will be no more apples for anybody else on planet Earth unless that core hits the earth and is regenerated. And it's bitter, it's hard, there's no juice in it whatsoever, but it's absolutely essential to keep the juicy apples being produced, you see? So sometimes when we look at the very heart of the Gaudiya Math or Bhakti Vinod Thakur's movement or ISKCON or any of the branches that have been spawned, you know, there's now at least 8 that I can count, 8 Hare Krishna movements in the world. Good luck to all of them. But if they learn anything from ISKCON, it should be that you have to learn this secret. What is the core that will be passed from one generation to another? Now, sociologists, anthropologists have said, if you don't get it right, you die in that generation. If you get it a little bit right, you die after 2 generations. But if you do get it right, the 3rd generation is that generation that proves that you've actually passed it on. So this generation, we have to get the Hare Krishna movement right. We're getting it right. We're also getting it wrong. But this is the generation that learns how to get it right. Okay? So give us a break. We've got another 2 generations to go before we prove. But something must be transmitted. And the things that are transmitted have to be transmitted by the person who is really the holder of the lineage. And the holder of the lineage is called the Acharya. So he's the one that passes it on to the next person. Even if only one person gets the pure message, the pure application of the message, and then puts it into practice with his followers, even if it's only one person. Because Prabhupada was only one person. And it's very interesting that Prabhupada was only one person, because he could have been 2 or 3. Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati didn't want just one person to come to the West. He sent 3 people to the West because he wanted to demonstrate that preachers have to have each other for company. And sometimes when our devotees have tried to emulate Prabhupada just being one lone preacher, one lone individual, they've flopped like anything. But a lot of what we do is based on the way that Prabhupada did it. But it also means that we can establish Prabhupada as the person who did what his Guru Maharaj required. And the international movement that Prabhupada started, he did by saying things which were desperately unpopular. Prabhupada came during the Vietnam War protests, in which everybody was talking about peace. And Prabhupada came with a book. On the front cover was somebody blue speaking to someone flesh-colored thousands of years ago, telling him to get up and fight. And the very people that were going on the anti-war protests were the people that Prabhupada attracted. Please tell me how that's possible. Prabhupada came with a message of celibacy, for God's sake, in 1960s America. Okay? A message of celibacy in America. Well, what do you want to do? You want to sell, I don't know. You want to sell fridges to Eskimos or, it's just something that, or vacuum cleaners or whatever Eskimos really don't need. Why would you do that? I'll tell you why you would do that, is to keep the teachings of your Guru Maharaj intact. And this is what Bhaktisananda Saraswati did with his Guru Maharaj also. So we have this situation, passing on that which is maybe unpopular. But curiously, if you do that, the most popular person in this universe and beyond will make what you say popular. Now, don't ask me, it's a real paradox. You say something unpopular and people go, I really don't like what he said, but I gotta get more of it. I really think these people are racist, discriminating, over-institutionalized, emotionally immature. Look at them dancing, singing in the street. How embarrassing. I'd never join a religious organization, but I just can't stop myself going to that kirtan. But their food is wonderful. Now, how is that possible? Because it's Krishna. And if you're pure and you teach pure and you pray pure and stay pure, one time Prabhupada said to his followers, he said, the difference between me and you, he said that you can fall down and I can never fall down. So then, yeah, I thought you'd find that amusing. So then the next day, Prabhupada was in front of the altar. And he stood there during the Govindam prayers, and he prayed just a little more. And so up in his room, after the Bhagavatam class, which is where the conversations would go on, they asked him, Prabhupada, may we ask what you were praying for? And he said, I was simply praying to Krishna that I would never fall down from spiritual life. And I said, but Prabhupada, yesterday you told us that you could never fall down. He said, yes, I can never fall down because I'm always praying to Krishna that I will never fall down. You see? Never took it for granted. One time Prabhupada gave an illustration of a member of the Gaudiya Math Sannyasi who said, I will never fall down. Tell Maya she can come to me anytime. Very shortly, he was gone. Okay, so know who you're dealing with. Know the opponent. Prabhupada said, sometimes there's a very tiny dog, and sometimes there's a very big dog. Okay, he was with his hands. Big dog, small dog. Okay, he said, but the small dog is barking at the big dog. But the big dog could kill him in an instant. Why is the small dog barking at the big dog? Okay? Because he has a collar and a lead connecting him to his master. He said, so if you always remember, here's my collar, and I'm connected with an invisible lead to Krishna. He said, then you can speak very boldly. He said, my Guru Maharaj spoke very boldly. Big dog, woof, woof. So preaching boldly, remaining pure to your own tradition, these are the qualities that we get through the acharyas of our sampradaya. Yes, we don't always make it. We don't always manage that. But today we're reflecting on someone who did. And the fact that he did means that you're sitting there reciting verses about what he did. That's the difference. He did it, and we're glorifying him for it. So he's a deliverer of the science of Krishna. The science of Krishna is a science. I'm going to stop doing this for a while. He's the deliverer of the science of Krishna. He's the personified energy of Sri Chaitanya's mercy. It says here, he's enriched with the conjugal love of Radha and Krishna. The unique contribution of the Gaudiya Sampradaya is this aspect of Radha and Krishna and the relationship played out between Radha and Krishna. But it is very delicate. It's like a very fragile orchid. You see? As soon as you come too close, you can look at the orchid from a distance, but as soon as you try to come too close, you may change the atmosphere. You see? The orchid may be affected. More of that later. Then it says, Rupa Siddhanta. He's exactly in the line of the revelation of Rupa Goswami. Sometimes we say that we are, we say that we are Prabhupada Nugas. Or is that the Ritvik people that say that? I think it is, isn't it? Yes. They want the Sampradaya to begin with His Divine Grace, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Prabhupada. Good try, boys, but it doesn't. Our Sampradaya actually begins with Rupa Goswami. Actually, it begins with Madhavendra Puri. Madhavendra Puri was the first to speak of the Radha Krishna Dasyam and to experience ecstatic symptoms. So how far back do we go? Well, we are followers of Rupa Goswami because he was a distinct follower of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. And the reason why Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati was preaching that we are Rupanugas is because at the time there was a lot of people who were Chaitanya Bhaktas, a lot of people who were followers of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, but they were members of what Bhaktivinoda Thakur, his father, called the blind Sampradayas. 13 of them who did not teach the teachings of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, but taught various combinations. The Bengal in those days was a melting pot. I've given this class many times, but if you look at the map, you'll find that Bengal is up near the Himalayas. It's on the Himalayan Silk Route from Persia to China. It was the first place to be conquered by the Muslims. And boy, when they went to a place, did they really conquer. They would come into your town, these Mughals, and they would immediately knock down the Hindu temples. They would kill the Brahmins. And one particular ruler, Aurangzeb, he refused to eat breakfast unless the first preparation of the breakfast was a heap of Brahmin threads freshly cut from a dead Brahmin. He wouldn't eat breakfast. He would fast until his army brought him these things. So when Bengal was smashed, it was really smashed. And hardly, you go to Bengal today, you could even miss Vedic culture, Vaishnav culture. You wouldn't even believe it had exist. Down in the south of India, you can't believe that the Muslims ever existed in India. Anyway, the Mughals were not just cruel to people of other religions, they were cruel to their own as well. So when the Sufis became prominent, they were also persecuted because they taught a different brand of Islam. So they were kicked out of what today is Iran and Iraq. And they also came wherever the conquering Muslim armies came, so they came to Bengal. And then the British came to Bengal because, why? Because it was a big port. There was a little village called Kaligat. And this little Kaligat was very helpful for shipping, trading spices, etc., etc. You could get to the Far East from Calcutta, as Kaligat became. So this is Bengal and Bangladesh. And boys, I thought we were going till 9 o'clock this morning. We're not, huh? You've got service. What service? I'm sorry? In the? What service? Using your computer, sir. Can you stay for the rest of the class? It's only half an hour. Please, come sit. This leaving halfway through the speaker's class, it does the speaker in, and you also don't get the complete picture. Thank you very much for staying. So we have a melting pot of different ideas. And into this melting pot of different ideas, there was fierce competition as to what would be the most popular idea. So Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati was born into that. It was a culture in which Bhaktivinoda Thakura had fought with these competing ideas and to a certain extent had won. He wrote many books in the English language to try and push back the tide of a sort of reformed Hinduism that brought the good bits of Christianity into Hinduism. And that was called, or one of them was called Brahma Samaj. Brahma Samaj was Hindus who felt embarrassed about deity worship. They felt that they couldn't, because the schools were being run by Catholics, and to be British, to be Christian, was therefore seen as upper class. The intellectuals, the universities were run by the British. So the more British you were, the more intelligent you were thought of, and the more likely you were to get a good job. So that was the caste system. It went Sudra, Vaishya, Kshatriya, Brahmin, British. This was the new caste system. So if you were British, you know, you're okay. All the top jobs went to the Brits. So then what you did was you got yourself a British education, you Christianized the Hinduism that you were brought up with, and you met together with other people and discussed it. And that's how the people like Ram Mohan Roy and Dayanand Saraswati formed the Brahma Samaj and the Arya Samaj, respectively, in the middle of the 19th century. So here was a difficulty that people were looking at, and people always look at the highest classes, just as now the scientist is the highest class, or the psychologist is the highest class, or the psychiatrist is the highest class. You know, if a person repeatedly chants Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare, and the parents are concerned, you take your young person to the highest class of individual who can tell you things about consciousness, and that's the psychiatrist. You don't go to a priest. Back in 1920, you would have gone to a priest. But 1920 was also the time when Freud and Jung started introducing what then became a new level in the caste system of intellectuality. So, into this caste system, Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati was born. So he was born in 1874, and he was born in Puri. And it was a Friday, 6th of February, at 3:30 in the afternoon. So it was today, according to the lunar calendar. He's born today, 3:30. And he was the fourth son of Bhaktivinoda Thakur. He was called Bimala Prasad. And Bimala Prasad refers to a story where Lord Shiva had got some prasad from Lord Narayan, and he gave some to his wife, and there was hardly any left, but he found some under his fingernail. It was just enough to keep his wife satisfied that she'd got the smallest portion of prasad from Lord Narayan. So she said, in future, please make sure that you save enough for me. So in Jagannath temple, after Jagannath has had his meals, all the chapan bhog goes to Bimala Devi, and then it's distributed to all the remnants of her. The goddess prasad is distributed to everyone. So you get Jagannath prasad, but she gets it first. So this is known as Bimala prasad. So they were living very close to the Jagannath temple, and when he was born, his umbilical cord was wrapped around his neck like a Brahmin thread from here to here, which they took as a good sign, early signs of something. At the age of 6 months, the Rathayatra was held, and this festival involves pulling the large chariots down the big road in Jagannath Puri, and the chariot stopped in front of Bhaktivinoda Thakura's house. At this time, he was the magistrate in Puri. And it stopped for 3 days, didn't move. And it just so happened that Bhaktivinoda Thakur wanted to take advantage of this occasion, and he performed the anaprasna, the giving of the first grains to Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati, or to Bimala Prasad at that time. And as he did so, the flower garland fell from Jagannath onto the shoulders, around the head of the child. We all know the story of the mango, how he stole a mango before it was offered to Krishna. And his father said, "Oh, you should not have taken that mango." And he said, "This is bhoga. This is meant for Krishna." So from that day forward, he never ate a mango. And this was indicative of his life to come, because his whole life was based on renunciation, renouncing that which is not useful for the service of Krishna. In 1881, they moved to Calcutta. There was a house built in Calcutta. And when they were building the house, a deity of Kurma, a small deity of Kurma, was revealed. So at that time, Bhaktivinoda Thakur gave his son Bimala Prasad this deity to worship, and he also gave him the required ritual procedures and the mantras to worship. He was just 8 years old. When he was 12, his father gave him a copy of the book that he'd written, the Chaitanya Shikshamrita. If you haven't read that book, it's a good book to read. Now that you're over 12 years of age, you can read that book. And it's the philosophy of Lord Chaitanya, but as it applies to other philosophies, it compares the teachings of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu to other teachings. He was very good at mathematics. He was very good at astrology. And the teachers, they nicknamed him Siddhanta Saraswati, one who knows the conclusions of the Shastras. When he was in seventh grade, this would be American seventh grade, which is how old? 13. So when he was 13, he received Harinam initiation from his father, who gave him a set of Tulsi beads. And he also gave him a Nasingha mantra. And this is also interesting, because it means that from the age of 13, he was chanting the Nasingha mantra. And this is something that was to carry on, because he also gave his disciples the worship of Nasingha Dev, which is not something that is always practiced. But when his disciples, sannyasi disciples, came to London, he gave them additional Nrisingadev mantras to chant for their protection, being in the West. And of course, when Prabhupada's health was not so good, he asked the devotees to chant the Nrisingadev prayers, which we chant every time we do an arti. So this is a tradition that is, you can take it back to this point. When he was 14, a significant event happened, that Bhaktivinoda Thakur started what he called a Vaishnav depository. He started a printing press in his house, which is kind of interesting. You know, you tell your family members, "Oh yeah, I'm bringing something home tonight." "And what are you bringing home?" "Well, I'm bringing home a printing press, and we're going to put it in the living room." But this was Bhaktivinoda Thakur. So you can see where Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati got the idea of having the printing press right in the temple itself. So at one end of the Chaitanya Mat temple, which was his head temple, the original, or Akar Gaudiya Mat, there's Radha Govinda. And at the other end of the temple, where we would have Prabhupada looking on at the deities, is the printing press. And if you look at the badge of the Gaudiya Mission, you see Radha and Krishna and the printing press. You see Mridanga cartels and the printing press. So it's very interesting. Prabhupada was once invited to come to the Kingsport Press. The Kingsport Press said that they had never printed as many books in their life before, in the life of the company. Kingsport Press was in Tennessee. And they had the you know, they said, well, the only book we print more of is the Bible, the Holy Bible that gets printed on the Kingsport Press. And your Swami, he is, you know, his book is the biggest book that we've ever printed, you know. So it's our privilege that he's coming here today. So Prabhupada came there to see where the Srimad Bhagavatam was being printed. And, of course, this printing press is, you know, it's a full-color press, about 80 feet long. And when Prabhupada saw it printing Srimad Bhagavatam, he paid his dandavats to the printing press. And the devotee, of course, the devotee said, so they all pay their obeisances too. And, of course, the Kingsport press workers were, hey, them Hare Krishnas are sure strange. But Prabhupada, when he stood up, he said, he said, this printing press is Srila Vyasadeva. This is Prabhupada's vision. This printing press is Srila Vyasadeva. I'll leave you with that thought. I'm not going to leave you yet. But I'll leave you with that thought. Because that is an interesting thing. So the printing press has been a recurring theme. And of course we know Mridanga and Brihat Mridanga. Now, the magazine that was started, as well as printing books that Bhaktivinoda Thakur had done, was the Sajjana Toshini. Sajjana Toshini, it means the pleasure of the devotees. Sometimes when we read out the book distribution scores, we say, for the pleasure of Krishna and for the pleasure of the devotees. So for the pleasure of the devotees, that magazine was created, the Sajjana Toshini. And it was just a Bengali language magazine. And it was all about the teachings of the Goswamis. But articles written by the Vaishnavas themselves, as well as reprints of Shastra. And the significant thing about that is that the Sajjana Toshini became the harmonist in the English version, and then the harmonist became Back to Godhead, which was Prabhupada at one point called the backbone of our movement. And it was when we were distributing 1 million copies every month. Now no longer. But 1 million copies of this particular magazine. Now our movement does not have a popularly written and illustrated magazine. We have the books, but we don't have the magazine. That's an interesting development. It's perhaps something we should look into, Vishrambha. Because there was always something easy to read. And as much as we think Prabhupada's books are easy to read, I can tell you that some people don't find them easy to read. Huh? Yes, the book points took over rather than the preaching value of something. That's true. That's what happened. But unfortunately, you can't feed people with book points. People don't come to Krishna consciousness through book points. Really, they don't care about your book points. They care about reading points, whether something can be read, digested, and understood. So what Prabhupada did was he wrote the books, and he had his followers write the Back to Godhead magazine. This is interesting. Sometimes they didn't all get it right, but he said, no, whatever you've written, distribute. Because he wanted to train his followers to write. So he said, what you write, you put in your way of speaking. Take what I have said, put it in your way of speaking, distribute. One of the very first Back to Godhead magazine distributors was His Grace Bob Dylan, who went out on the street selling Back to Godhead magazines, some of the early ones. Just thought you might like to know that. Let's get back to Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati. He would go to what we now call sanghas or namahattas or these groups. Wherever you've had a movement of Vaishnavas, there have been groups to sit together and discuss Shastra. And he would go, and there were people like Shishir Kumar Ghosh. There were Vaishnavas who were friendly with Bhaktivinoda Thakur. And he would go to these assemblies in Calcutta. When he was young, Srila Prabhupada, our Srila Prabhupada, also used to go to a sangha. Not a lot of people know that, but Prabhupada used to go to Sangha meetings with his parents. Okay? And I'm looking over in this general area, because that's very important for us. The Prabhupada, sometimes he said they would go on their cart, the horse and cart, and they would go across Calcutta, and they would go to a place where they were reading and discussing Bhagavad Gita. So did Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati. And he took a copy of the Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu with him, and he would listen. He wouldn't say anything at this point, he's only 14, but he was listening very carefully. Now, it's just interesting that Shishir Kumar Ghosh was a person who had a huge library. And just a few months ago, the grandchildren of Shishir Kumar Ghosh have given his entire library to ISKCON. And we now are looking after that library. Most of it is in Bengali. But Hari Sori and Janakaraj, actually, they are. There is a division of, you know, it's the Bhaktivedanta Library, and they're preserving the books for posterity. So the family, the Ghosh family, was very happy to for us to look after them. So then we come to 1892, and he's only 18, but he starts performing Chaturmasya at the age of 18. Chaturmasya, of course, is where you give up lots of things, and you do austerities and disciplines. And he used to meet together with other students in a place called Beedon Square in Calcutta, and he would debate with them for many hours after his studies. And he formed his own society of students, his own KSOC, called the August Assembly. So all the students used to gather together, university people used to gather together, and they would discuss these things. That was in the 1890s. Of course, around about that time, things were sort of warming up with the anti-British movement. And there must have been some enlivening discussions there. He didn't want to continue his studies after a particular point, because he felt that he was being fast-tracked towards marriage. He said, if I stay here, university, then a job. So he wanted to do something different. So in 1898, he went and he was teaching he took up a residency with the king of Tripura, and taught the princes. So he was teaching them different subjects like mathematics and Bengali and English and various things like that. And the king liked him so much that he, after he'd finished teaching the princes, he said, would you look after my estate in Calcutta? So he was doing that for a while, and he was getting a small pension from that. And he carried on receiving that pension until 1908. And at that time, there was other things happening for him. Bhaktivinoda Thakur had moved to Godruma in Navadvip to be closer to where Lord Nityananda Prabhu began the Namahata, the marketplace of the holy name. He'd taken a break from his job in order to build a house in a particular place. And so influential was Bhaktivinoda Thakur, of course, that in Godruma, they brought the railway line just past his house, which is pretty influential. And so Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati was growing up in an atmosphere where he was helping his father to print books. He himself was now giving classes and debating with other persons, and very seriously committed to all the practices that we would now identify with being a devotee. He would give classes on the Chaitanya Charitamrita, and Bhaktivinoda Thakur would listen to his son giving classes on the Chaitanya Charitamrita, which I thought was quite nice. He went on a South Indian tour in 1905, And he went to a place called Sri Parambadura, which is the birthplace of Ramanujacharya. And there he met with a Swami and discussed with him the principles of taking sannyas. Sannyas in our line from the six Goswamis was highly unusual. Sanatana Goswami himself said that anyone who wears the orange color usually becomes proud. So everyone, there was no sannyas. It was so this was a new thing that he was contemplating introducing. And so he spoke with the Ramanuja Swami. And this was not going to be the last occasion. There was another occasion later on when he went to Kashi or Varanasi. And again, he had 3 days of talks with the Ramanuja people in order to understand how sannyas fits in with everything, because there was a problem. He wanted to start a preaching organization in a culture that really respected the orange cloth, the saffron cloth. At that time, there were also the beginnings of the Ramakrishna mission. Of course, Ramakrishna and Vivekananda were actually related to Bhaktivinoda Thakur. They were closer than we like to think, actually. So they knew each other, and there was a lot of conversation between the two. But as the Ramakrishna mission adopted not sannyas, but there's no tridanda, but it was the orange cloth, and they wore kurtas and dyed them orange. So he saw that, but he wanted to introduce tridanda sannyas as a principle, because in Bengali society you could see that they were respectful of the preacher, the sannyas preacher, whereas the Vaishnav tradition at that time was to come away from the city, and live in seclusion, either in Vrindavan or in Navadvip. And Vrindavan and Navadvip, well, of course, Navadvip is still very secluded, you know. But Vrindavan, if you go to Vrindavan now, the first time I went to Vrindavan was 1977, and the Hare Krishna temple, you know, I was thinking, why did Prabhupada want the Krishna Balaram temple built so far out of town? It was stuck in the middle of fields. And of course, if you go there now, it's highly, highly congested, so much so that the traffic has, you know, forced them to widen the road. So this is the effect. You go to a holy place, which is a place where the holy men go, because they want peace and quiet, and then you start telling other people that it's so wonderful that they can go there, and then it becomes a non-holy place. Or you go there and it's still a holy place, but you don't feel holy because there's no peace and quiet, and there's trucks and tourists, and then it's a big problem. So it's sort of our movement has done that in many places. It's an unfortunate consequence of being popular. Prabhupada built the Bombay temple in a swamp, but the city expanded and it's now the most popular place to live. Or the Bhubaneswar temple was built outside Bhubaneswar. Now it's, I guess you could say, somewhere in the middle of Bhubaneswar. Very, very popular. Where else have we done it? Well, in Detroit. We did it in Detroit. And it was, you know, the Fisher Mansion was on the, you know, it was the part of town where no one wanted to go after sunset. But things change where the holy people go. Hence the expression Kshetrabasi Mahapapi. Means, anyway, you know what that means if you speak Hindi. So really sinful people like to go to holy places in order to become purified. So anyway, Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati had a decision to make. Either he was going to carry on a reclusive tradition, or he was going to start a preaching movement. So we see here the beginnings of all of this. But at that time, he was 1905, it was 18, in 1905, he was 31 years old, and his father directed him to take Bhagavati Diksha from Gorakishore Das Babaji. And of course, you know the story. He was very highly educated, and Gaurakishore Das Babaji could not even write his own name. So he said to his father, he said, you want me to have a guru who can't read? How is that possible? You know, but his father said no. And eventually, of course, the Thakur said, no, either you take initiation from him or you don't come back to this house. Now, these days, if a parent says, you do this or don't come back to this house, it's, okay, I won't come back to the house, right? And you live somewhere else. But in those days, to be cast out of your father's house, especially since your father was, practically speaking, your Shiksha, Diksha, Guru, your Acharya, your saint in your life. This was, so he had to see the hand of the Lord there. So that whole episode is there. And as soon as that had taken place, he did something that was quite unusual. He started chanting 300,000 names of God every day. And 300,000 names is how many rounds? 192 rounds. Gaurakishore Das Babaji was very pleased. He was very happy. So he began also preaching against the caste system, the rigid caste system, which at that time had become pretty much a fossilized remnant of something that used to be good, but it fossilized into old Brahmins that were basically unhelpful to any other type of people and who were just Brahmins for making money. 1906, he began collecting information on the four sampradayas. Now, this is significant because no one had ever done it before. And the reason it's significant is because he wanted to make the preaching platform that the movement of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu is an amalgamation of all the best parts of every Vaishnav sampradaya. And this was a preaching platform for him in India. And later on, it led to the very first Gaudiya Math temple where the deities are. And you've been there, you go to the deities, and around is the four Vaishnav sampradayas with a murti of, you know, Ramanuja and Madhva and Nimbarka and Vishnu Swami, plus the presiding deity of that sampradaya, you know, Brahma for the Brahma sampradaya, etc., etc. So he wanted to show that worship of Radha and Krishna for the rest of the Kali Yuga is the topmost consideration of the Vaishnava sampradaya. And he wanted the different streams of Vaishnavism to come together so that preaching commonly, they could turn back the tide of Kali Yuga. This is really the aim of a Vaishnava, that people are suffering, and they're suffering because of different manifestations of Kali Yuga. Wherever you see that people are suffering, and if you don't know that people are suffering, may I suggest you go to the A&E department of any hospital on a Friday night between the hours of, let's say, 10 and 2 in the morning, and you will see that is the Battle of Kurukshetra being reenacted all over the country. So people suffer because they want to run away from the pain that their life has become. Their life has become painful because they made the wrong choices. They make the wrong choices because they have insufficient information to make the right choices. And he said that the teachings of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu will at least inform people so that they can have a sattvic life. At least have a sattvic life where you don't make so many mistakes so there's no pain. At least we can do that. But if the Vaishnav sampradayas join together under the banner of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu and teach the Maha Mantra and the principles of Rupa Goswami, then we have a united force. So he was always thinking like that. But he wanted to distinguish between the caste system where Brahmins... Please be blessed, you two, if you have to rush. Be my guest if you need to go now. Okay. So then a significant thing here happened at the age of 32. He took his first disciple at the age of 32 years old. He'd only just been initiated by Gaurakishore Das Babaji, and 1 year later, he gave initiation. So why did he not send, you know, these young people that were coming to him to Gaurakishore Das Babaji or his father? This is very interesting, you see, because normally we're told that the etiquette is that such and such, such and such. But no, his father wanted him to start a preaching mission. He actually wanted him to start a preaching mission. In this beautiful book, in which we will see a beautiful picture of him. This is him following Chaturmasya. Well, that's him as a sannyasi, so I won't show you that yet. But his father wrote him a letter. And his father wrote him a letter that you should hear, because this is the letter that really sets him up to do the Gaudiya Math, which sets Prabhupada up, which sets all of you up. So it's a very important letter. This is my dear son, Saraswati. People of this world who are proud of their own aristocratic birth cannot attain real aristocracy. Therefore, they attack the pure Vaishnavas, saying they have taken birth in low-class families because of their sins. He was telling him, you know, that you must be strong in the face of so much opposition. We must have opposition to this. He was getting older. Thus, they commit offenses. The solution to this problem is to establish the order of Daivi Varnashram Dharma, something you have started doing. You should know that to be the real service to the Vaishnavas. Because pure devotional conclusions are not being preached, all kinds of superstitions and bad concepts are being called devotion by such pseudo-sampradayas as Sahaja and Atibari. Please always crush these anti-devotional concepts by preaching pure devotional conclusions and by setting an example through your personal conduct. Okay? So preaching against false conclusions. Please make great effort so you can start the parikrama of Sridham Navadvip as soon as possible. It is by those actions that everyone in the world will receive Krishna Bhakti. Please try very hard to make sure that the service to Sri Mayapur will become a permanent thing and will become brighter and brighter every day. The real service to Sri Mayapur can be done by acquiring printing presses, distributing devotional books, and Sankirtan, preaching. Please do not neglect, I'm going to quiz you on this afterwards, please do not neglect to serve Sri Mayapur or to preach for the sake of your own reclusive bhajan. When I am not present anymore, please take great care to serve Sri Mayapur Dham, which is so dear to you. This is my special instruction to you. People who are like animals can never attain devotion. Therefore, never take their suggestions, but do not let them know this, directly or indirectly. I had a special desire to preach the significance of such books as Srimad Bhagavatam, Shat Sandarbha, and Vedanta Darshan. You have to accept that responsibility. Sri Mayapur will prosper if you establish an educational institution there. Never make any effort to collect knowledge or money for your own enjoyment. Only to serve the Lord will you collect these things. Never engage in bad association, either for money or for some self-interest. So there are at least 8 instructions there. At least 8. I'm not going to quiz you because time is marching on. But the point here is that with this letter, he gives him instructions to do what he did for the rest of his life, to start the Gaudiya Math. Now, normally if someone says the words, okay, I'll say an expression and you tell me what comes into your mind first. Varnashram Dharma. Cows. Right? But Varnashram Dharma means sannyas. That's what it means. Now, how do we make that out? You know, usually when Prabhupada talks about Varnashram Dharma, it means cows. And normally devotees think, well, we get a farm and we get some cows. And the sannyasis can stay in the cities and preach. Unfortunately, without sannyasis, you don't have Varnashram system. Okay. Now, you have to establish sannyas in order to resurrect the Varnashram system. Why? Because, well, it's, you know, if you know these things, then you know. It is not, as one sannyasi once said, he sat in the Bhagavatam class, and he said, wearing his, you know, holding his danda and wearing his, you know, saffron cloth, he said, we have nothing to do with Varnashram. We have nothing to do with Varnashram. Excuse me, Maharaj, you're sitting there in the clothing of a person in the Varnashram system. Varna, Ashram, get it? There's four of them. One of them is sannyas. We have nothing to do with Varnashram. So Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati said, how to reestablish Varnashram, which would be focused on service to Krishna. So that is why he eventually decided to take sannyas. From this time, he started making disciples. He had a young person who was an expert kirtan singer come from a place called Balal Digi, which is just up the road, just down the road. He came, and another person from Jessore, and he looked after them. And he gave his famous lecture when his father was sick in 1911. He must have been 34 at the time. And this was to separate the Brahmins from the Vaishnavas. Not separate them, but separate the conception. So he went into the assembly, and he spoke, first of all, in such a way as to establish Brahmins as very important persons. And the Brahmins that were gathered there, they were very happy. But then he turned to the Vaishnavas, because they were sitting separately. There was Brahmins, caste Brahmins on one side and Vaishnavas on the other side. And the idea was that if you were a Vaishnav, you could come from any caste, and the Brahmins would not sit next to other caste Vaishnavas, even if they'd taken shelter of Vishnu. So he started glorifying the Vaishnavas with Shastric quotations. And the Brahmins could then see that his glorification of the Vaishnavas, which put them in the ascendant compared to the Brahmins, was so conclusive that they had no argument. And so they were very happy there. A little while later, he did something very important. Those of us who have received the various Gayatri mantras that we chant every day, the fourth and fifth Gayatri relates to Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, and he said he reestablished the eternality of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu and the worthiness of chanting the name of Gaura and worshipping the form of Gaura. You think it was easy to establish, you know, Radha Krishna were accepted, but the form of Gauranitai, the fact that we have Gauranitai deities, it dates back to this time in 1911. After he'd made his Brahmin and Vaishnav speech, he also established the worship of Gaura and Nitai. And, of course, if you worship Gaura and Nitai, you need the Gayatri mantras to worship them. And so there was an awful lot of philosophical wrangling to get to that point. So at that point, we receive those mantras. I'll go a bit quicker now. Do we have another 10 minutes? I can finish in 10 minutes. There's no breakfast. So if you're dying of boredom, you can leave, but if you're not, then... thank you, Nelly. It's one of the downsides of not having English as your first language, that you may miss out on the subtleties of it. They established a printing press in Calcutta in 1913. His father wanted to print the following books: Chaitanya Charitamrita, Bhagavad Gita, but with the commentary of Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur. And that may seem like an insignificant thing. You know, you join this movement when the Bhagavad Gita is already printed, the Chaitanya Charitamrita is already printed. There's a lot that we take for granted. You know, you look around and you think, well, it's already up and running. What do they need me for? I always say, when I give classes, that each and every one of you will do something significant that has historical significance and permanent and lasting value in your life. I don't know what it is, you don't know what it is, but it will be the beginning of something that lasts 200-300 years. Now, how do I know that? Why do I know that? Just because you've taken shelter of Krishna. And Krishna will use you as his instrument to do various things. And that's what it means, really, to say, Krishna, please allow me to serve you. So, here, he also, along with CC and Bhagavad Gita, he also printed another book called Krishna, Gaura Krishna Nodoy by Govinda Das, something that has sort of disappeared now, but it was to show that Gaura is Krishna. And this was written by a poet in Orissa. And they thought that printing that is that two things. They had to print books that were philosophical canons. Canon doesn't mean a gun. It means a canonical text. It means an essential text by which the lineage of the Sampradaya can be. So that's things like Vedanta Sutra or Vishwanath Chakravarti's commentaries on Bhagavad Gita. These things, these are the essential texts that get passed down through the Sampradaya. But they were also concerned with popular literature that even people who were only not very interested in Krishna consciousness could pick. So Bhaktivinoda Thakur used to take the popular melodies sung by the very people that he was preaching against and put them to the words that he was writing. So we have a lot of, you know, we have a lot of, he didn't write the tunes, he wrote the lyrics. So he wrote the lyrics and borrowed the tunes from the Sahajas, because the Sahajas were damn good musicians. You knew when the Sahajas came to town, they'd get everybody would come out of their houses. You know, no radio, no TV, no Bollywood. You know, hey, you know, the musicians are in town. So the musicians came to town. There was a dancer with them. It was a whole show, you know. And the only person that would get a bigger crowd is the magician when he came, the traveling Bengali magician. Now, the Sufis, they were very good musicians, not magicians, but musicians. And they would come to town and they would sing songs about Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. These were Sufis. These were mystical Muslims. And they would sing songs about Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. Now, why would they do that? Well, because if you sing songs about Chaitanya Mahaprabhu in Bengal, people throw money at you. If you sing songs about Allah, people say, very nice anyway. So, when they went to the Muslim village, they would sing songs about Allah, and tears would come in their eyes. When they went to the Hindu villages, they would sing songs about Krishna, and their lower lip would tremble, and tears would come in their eyes. So wherever they went, they were rolling in it. They were cashing in. Around their neck was Tulsi beads, Rudraksha beads, crystal beads. So, they were the sort of new age people of the Victorian era. And people loved them. The only difficult thing was that they didn't follow any religious principles. They had their girlfriends with them, sometimes more than one. They had, a taste for non-vegetarian food. They used to love the hubbly bubbly, the hookah. And it wasn't ordinary tobacco that was there. It was, you know, some other weeds that are grown in India. And this was what was, the popular preachers of the day. So now imagine if we had 1,000 preachers in this country preaching Krishna consciousness. Wouldn't we be able to spread Krishna consciousness faster? In every town and village we had a preacher. Wouldn't that be wonderful? Now imagine that each and every one of those 1,000 preachers was addicted to ganja, had 2 girlfriends in different parts of the town where they lived, okay, was non-vegetarian, but was singing and dancing the Hare Krishna mantra in the street. Now, do you think we'd spread Krishna consciousness? I don't think so. What would get spread is something else. And this was the situation that they had to deal with. So he borrowed the tunes and he wrote the lyrics himself. You see? And it's very interesting how they did it. So moving swiftly on. So two things. Popular literature and literature which is unpopular for the masses. Do you understand the principle? Tunes that no one can follow and tunes that people already love. I understand there's a theme building up here. Okay? Okay? Popular temples that people can come to and out-of-the-way places where only Vaishnavas would dare live. Popular things that people can do to develop their Krishna consciousness, and things that no one can follow, such as living on basically pureed rice and dal with no salt or spices, eating only once a day, off the floor, no shoes, during Chaturmasya. No one can copy that. You don't preach that. That's what you do. What you preach is purity, but a way that people can be in touch with that purity. So Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati was always scratching his head together with his father to work out ways that you wouldn't compromise on purity, but you would get the message out to the masses. Unfortunately, in 1914, his father passed away in Puri. But before that time, he had seen his son give class and lead kirtan in Jagannath Puri before big groups of people, and he knew that his movement was in safe hands, and he passed away. And in 1915, Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati finished the Chaitanya Charitamrita commentary. Now we have two commentaries that Prabhupada works from. One is the Amrita Prabaha Bhashya of Bhaktivinoda Thakur, and his spiritual master's commentary. So when you read, for instance, in Prabhupada's purports, that if you take the train, it's the third station along, and you get off at that train, and there is a temple, and it is a very small temple that such and such used to visit, that's all Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati. That's how Prabhupada was able to do the Chaitanya Charitamrita so quickly. Not that there's nothing of Prabhupada in the Chaitanya Charitamrita, but a lot of the details about this temple is here, and this place is there, and this, that's, you know, Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati. So he built on that, and he gave us everything in English. Then another great disaster happened. 1914, his father passed away. 1915, Gaurakishore Das Babaji passed away. So pretty much Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati, just imagine how he felt. He was alone in the world with this incredible responsibility for teaching the teachings of Rupa Goswami, Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. He had to print the literature. You know, we have a movement that we can belong to. He had, you know, he had some friends. He was still young. But anyway, then his disciple later on said that my Guru Maharaj was depressed at that time. He was grieving. But in the middle of his depression, he had a divine vision. And in this divine vision, everybody was in that divine vision. Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, the six Goswamis, Baladev, his father, Gaurakishore Das Babaji, everybody was in that vision. And everybody was encouraging him. And they were pointing up to a temple in which there was Radha and Krishna, and they said, come on, come with us. We're going to that place, you can come with us too. So he had that vision. And he knew from then that, you know, he would be all right. So only 3 years later, after having talked to these, you know, Ramanuja people about how to resurrect Vaishnav sannyas, you know, he took sannyas. He had disciples around him when he took sannyas. There was a ceremony. But at that moment, he didn't wear shoes. He used to wear a kurta. He didn't wear a kurta, he only wore a chada. And he took the saffron color and began preaching. And immediately things began to change, because when you're going in a society and you speak the language of the society, you dress in a particular way, you get the benefit there. So he wrote, he was very you could say he was very pugilistic. Pugilistic means spoiling for a fight. You know, not in a bad way, not in a way that a person does on a Friday night when they've had too much to drink, you know. But it was, all right, here's the situation. You know, I've come to give something, and there's you know, the local society is capitulated to Victorian values, to the British, to the new intellectuals, to compromised understandings of Vaishnavism? What am I to do? And so he began his preaching mission in a spirit of, all right, there's a lot to be done. Let me start by doing it. So he wrote a little book called, it was 29 questions and 29 answers. And it was called The Answers to the Questions of the Critics. People who are criticizing Vaishnavas for this. And this feeds into, he also wrote a book called Prakriti Rasa Shatadushini, which was 100 arguments against Mayavad. Now, the thing is that these books feed into the very sort of heart and soul of the Gaudiya Math that he created, which feeds into the heart and soul of ISKCON. And sometimes when we read Prabhupada's purports, we sometimes feel, why is Prabhupada getting so angry at, you know, this person and that person and this person and that person? And so much so that when Sutapa Prabhu asked me to write an introduction to the Veda compilation, I felt that I had to explain Prabhupada's stance on this. It comes from a long tradition. But the point is that it is a fight. That it is a fight. And people are suffering because of... you know, there are people campaigning about various things. There's always a campaign involved to rid the world of certain evils, whether it's child abuse, spouse abuse, HIV/AIDS, hunger, thirst, dictatorial regimes in the Middle East is a popular one that's going on right at this moment. We wake up this morning and we don't know, you know, what's happening in one of those countries. We're fighting against malaria. We're fighting against, well, we used to fight against smallpox and polio. But wherever you find a fight going on, you'll find a fight on the causes of these things. And it's not, as Mr. Blair said, you know, tough on crime, tough on the causes of crime. Well, you have to know the cause of crime. You know, Bhagavad Gita 2:61, 62. Dhyayato vishayan pumsa. If you contemplate the objects of the senses, you get attached. You become greedy. You become angry that you can't have them. And then you go out and rob someone else. But we live in a society where people are being encouraged to want stuff, even though that stuff will not make them happy. And even by the time they get stuff, they will want something else. But the economy is driven by people wanting stuff. And in order to want stuff, it has to be manufactured somewhere. And if it's manufactured in a place, the manufacturing processes will generate stuff into the air, which is causing global warming. So the teachers of the Krishna consciousness movement are saying, you don't need stuff to be happy. You can live in a better world, a crime-free world. Because either you want stuff and you can't get it, and because you can't get it, you have drink and drugs to forget that you've bereft of these things. What people really need, of course, is love. All you need is. But you get that in a particular way. If you feel God's love, you don't need so much stuff. That's the basic message of this movement. And you can experience God's love for you if you chant this mantra. If you don't preach anything else, if you just do those things, if in the process of chanting that mantra, you can stop killing things that have got faces, that would be very nice. If you stop either putting things into your body that don't actually help you, that would be nice. And it will help you do the chanting better. And that's really what are a few simple messages. But if you think that the Krishna consciousness movement is just delivering an abstract philosophy that's got no relevance at all to what politicians are talking about and scratching their heads, Prabhupada said, he said, you should preach that this movement can solve the problems of the world. Trace back any problem that you read today in a newspaper or listen to on the radio, and you will find that either the four regulator principles or the experience of God's love would put an end to that problem. Okay, so Bhaktisiddhanta said how to unpackage that and give it to people. That's the thing. So he starts temples. You know, so he takes sannyas, and in 1920, he takes sannyas in 1918. By 1920, 1920, something else happens that could upset him. His mother passes away. And as a sannyasi, he goes to her bedside. This is Bhagavati Devi. As a sannyasi, he goes to her bedside, and she says, "Son, you take the teachings of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu and deliver this world." Every sannyasi should have a mother like that. And she so much cared for the message that her husband, Bhaktivinoda Thakur, I mean, ladies, imagine being married to Bhaktivinoda Thakur and then having a son like Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati. What a family. Okay. So then he says, "Yes, mother, I will do that." So then he gets, you know, some charge from that. And in November of the same year, he initiates his first sannyas disciple. And this is Bhakti Pradeep Tirtha Maharaj. It was the first sannyas disciple of what would be only 18 sannyas disciples, because his life would come to an end prematurely only 16 years later. So within 16 years, he made 18 sannyasis. So that's a sannyasi every year. That's some preaching. So in 1921, he revived Navadvipa Parikrama, something which is still going today. Prabhupada wanted to make Mayapur his world headquarters, and somehow or another we did it. He wanted the book distribution to funnel funds into Mayapur, and we did it. You see, all the programs that Prabhupada wanted can be traced to very key elements in Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati's life. He opened up a temple in 1922, 1921. He started something called the Madhva Gaudiya Math. He named it after Madhvacharya. Philosophically, we have a very limited relationship with Madhvacharya, if you actually study Madhva's philosophy. But we are linked by sampradayic connection. So he named this Gaudiya Math in Dhaka, now the capital of the country of Bangladesh. At that time, all one country known as Bangla. And then he, in the same year, in the next few months, he established the Purushottam Math in Puri. And Puri was an important place. Puri was a very important place, still is. Even though we can't go to the temple there, it's one of the places that Shankaracharya, you know, before there was a big Buddhist community there, and the Vaishnav community, and the Shankarite community. So it's a very important place of influence. So he established a temple there. And every year, of course, the Gaudiya Math, which means the organization based around the temple that he established in Mayapur, they have a big Harinam Sankirtan there. So then he began in 1922 the publishing of the Gaudiya. The Gaudiya became the most popular spiritual magazine in Bengal at the time. And at that time, it was a time of people using their Bengali identity against the British. There was a lot of, you know, so the British sent a secret policeman to the Gaudiya Math because they thought that, you know, they're printing this magazine, you know, something must be happening at the HQ. Just as today, MI5, I was told by one government minister, he told me that MI5 have young people joining Muslim organizations all over the country. You can't tell who they are. You know, they're so concerned about the proliferation of terrorism. Sorry, is this being broadcast? So he said, so in the same way, the secret police, they went and they went to the Gaudiya Math. And in the Gaudiya Math, they sat there listening to the classes. And eventually, the classes made so much sense that this particular secret policeman became an initiated disciple. However, there were disciples of Bhaktisiddhanta who were previously involved in sedition, involved in, you know, blowing up things against the British and, you know, blowing up train tracks and various things. And they also gave up their ways and joined the Gaudiya Mutt. And one of them then went on to become the sannyas guru of Srila Prabhupada. So we have, you know, they were doing things. They were active in various ways. Very well known. Then another person came. They thought he was a secret policeman. They thought he was a spy. There's a lot going on at this time. You know, Gandhi is stirring the people up in India at this time. So the British are very, they're very worried. Previously, Bhaktivinoda Thakur arrested someone on behalf of the British government for being anti-British. So he is, you know, anyway, into the mix here comes someone who, he's sitting there very patiently, but he never asks any questions. So he's sitting there, he doesn't ask any questions at all to Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati as he's preaching, so they think, we've got him, he's a spy. He's a spy from the British. See? But it turned out he wasn't listening any questions because he was had such rapt attention. The other person was a secret policeman. Now, you know, the suspicions were about this person, but no. And that became Sridhar Maharaj. Now, around this time, of course, they have a place in Altadunga Junction in Calcutta. And it's around the time, the Gandhian times. And you know the story at on the roof of that building. A young man came who was involved in Gandhi's movement. And he came and he challenged Bhaktisiddhanta. And he said, actually, your movement won't take off until we've got rid of the British. And then Bhaktisiddhanta debated with him and said, no, young man. He said, this movement is far too important to wait until the British have gone. He said, we need to spread Krishna consciousness now. And of course, that young man was called Abhay Charan Day. Now in 1977, when Srila Prabhupada came here for the first time, for the last time, he sat there and he didn't say very much. He couldn't say very much. He wasn't too well. But when Tamal Krishna Maharaj was recounting the story of Prabhupada's life with all the different incidents, he got to this point and he didn't know what year it was. So then Prabhupada said, 1922. It was the only thing that Prabhupada said, 1922. So Prabhupada counted 1922 as being an extremely important year. So who would know that that meeting would develop into what it has developed into? Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati had not had a Vyasa Puja ceremony. He waited until he was aged 50. In 1924. But even then, when he had a Vyasa Puja ceremony, he addressed his disciples, Amar Vipad Taran Bandugan. He said, my friends who rescue me from danger. He regarded his disciples. Gorkishore Das Babaji used to call him my Prabhu. You know, my master. Okay. And Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur used to address his disciples as my Prabhus, my friends who rescue me from danger. It's a very healthy way for someone to look at their disciples. Is Krishna sending these boys to actually help me? Then 1927 came The Harmonist, the English magazine. 1930 came the very famous Bagh Bazar temple. Some very rich disciple said, Guru Maharaj, I have money, I'd like to help you with your mission. And at that time, he was thinking, actually, our activities in the city should increase. We've established Mayapur. You know, we have a temple there now, so a small temple they had. Yogapit wasn't developed. Lord Chaitanya's birthplace wasn't developed, but they had the Chaitanya Mat. So he said, yes, all right, let us build a big building. So they bought land in the middle of the city, and they built the Bagh Bazar temple. Now, it's interesting that a few years later, after they built that building, of course, he confidentially told our Srila Prabhupada that I'd rather take the marble off the walls and sell the marble to print books. This was just 3 years after opening it. Why? Because he had seen disciples arguing. And these two disciples that were arguing were people that he had given sannyas to. And he stood there in the doorway watching them argue, these two men argue. And it was only after a minute or two that they saw that he was watching them. And then they turned around and they offered their obeisances. And he said, they said, oh, sorry, Guru Maharaj, sorry. He said, no, no. He said, it's not your fault that you're arguing. He said, it's my fault. He said, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, he took Maharajas and he turned them into beggars, referring to, you know, Prataparudra. He said, but I have taken beggars and turned them into Maharajas. This is my mistake. And then he turned and left. Oh dear. I think they remembered that instruction. So then he did something which gave us something which we don't do now, because Prabhupada pushed it like anything, and no one in the Hare Krishna movement pushes it now. And it was the waxworks exhibitions. He had a wonderful show in Mayapur. And it's very interesting that this show was not just, you know, what we would put on. It was a show involving agricultural utensils, the latest seeds, the latest products. It was all trades. It was like a county show. And there was a fairground. There was all different types of things that people would want to get into. But there was kirtan going on. And it wasn't that smart. There was things that all the local people would want to go to, and, you know, enjoy. But there was kirtan going on. And he put it on in Mayapur. And he also had 30 display booths where the pastimes of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu were done, not in waxworks, not in the hot Mayapur sun, but something called putul, which is where you get a bamboo framework, and then you wind it round with straw, and then you put clay on the top, and it is, you know, just different scenes. One of the particular scenes was a preaching scene. He got into a lot of trouble for it, because it showed a Shivite Brahmin taking a Shalagram Shila off the altar and using, and it, you know, sort of froze the Brahmin like that, you know, with his tripundra. And he showed the Brahmin cracking almonds with the Shalagram Shila. You know the story? It's a famous story. That the king engaged the Brahmin to worship Shalagram Shila. Okay, you're supposed to do your puja yourself. Isn't it right, dear Lalita? You're supposed to do your own puja, not pay someone else to do it. So I'm a king, I can pay someone to do my devotional service for me. Well, actually, no, you can't. So then the king one time spotted, king or the rich man, he spotted the Brahmin, and he had these bardam, and he was taking the Shalagram Shila and using it to crack the nuts, which is the very opposite of devotional service. You're engaging Krishna in your devotional service. Why? Because you want to eat the nuts, not offer them. So he got into a lot of trouble with the Brahmins and the Shivites, and eventually it went all the way to court. There was a big court case in Calcutta that he was pouring scorn over the established social order. Anyway, one sannyasi went there and gave all the evidence. And when he said, Guru Maharaj, what shall I tell them? He said, they're saying, why have you chosen a Shivite? He said, but, you know, you could have chosen a nondescript. He said, all right. He said, you tell them that we will change the tripundra on the waxworks exhibition to the udrapundra. And you turn that person, that figure, into a follower of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. He said, because I don't want anybody thinking that this sort of using Krishna for my service cannot be performed by anyone who is a follower of Chaitanya. We can also make that mistake. And so they did. They changed it. So anyway, they escaped. There's one famous verse. And if you know this verse, you will be able to deal with anyone who is a follower of, of course, just passed on, but a follower of any contemporary Gaudiya Swami who says that these are the teachings of Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati. He, when they opened up the temple in Bagh Bazar, they brought the deities from one old temple to the new temple, and they brought them in a chariot. And as they were going along, yes, they chanted the Hare Krishna mantra, but he also wrote a song for the occasion that perfectly expressed what the Gaudiya Math that he'd established was there to do. And it goes like this. Pujala Ragapata Gaurava Bhange Matala Harijana Vishayarange. And they chanted that in Kirtan. So please raise your hands. Pujala Raga Pata Gaura. Excuse me. Gaurava. Bhange. Matala. Harijana. Vishaya. Rangi. And this is a very, very important verse, and it's been carved in stone over the door of one Gaudiya Vaishnav temple. And it says that our object of worship is the raga attained by the gopis for Krishna. But we will keep that always in front of us and above us. And we will humbly go on doing our duty. This is a strange song. But what it means is that you keep the divine pastimes of Radha and Krishna always in front of you, always something that you never quite reach, always something above you that you can never quite understand. And if you do that, you will never be you'll never encounter the pride of thinking that you have attained Krishna. And of course, this was a commentary on people who like to dwell inordinately on the pastimes of Krishna without the qualification, something that his father had spoken about, something that he spoke about, something that our Prabhupada had spoke about, and something which everybody in ISKCON should speak about. 1932, he went down south. He established quite a large temple, actually in Madras, now called Chennai. If you've been there, you think, boy, this, you know, the Gaudiya Math was really, really moving. You know, it's a big building. The big hall and accommodation block, and you know, something's really happening. And the foundation stone is still there. The British governor, you would always bring in the British governor to lay the foundation stone of the building. Okay? Just like we bring in, you know, Michael, what was his name? Not Michael Gove, we bring him, but to open the Goshala? Who opened the Goshala? Desmond Grieve? Dominic Grieve. Dominic Grieve, okay. So he would always give the opportunity to the British governor of the day to look after the ceremony, to head up the ceremony, to be the chief guest of honor, give it a certain kudos. He also started at that time Bhakti Shastri. You'll be pleased to know that Bhakti Shastri dates back to then. And also the Braj Mandala Parikrama. The Braj Mandala Parikrama, where you go around Vrindavan. Now, when I did that Braj Mandala Parikrama, you do it bare feet, and it's 128 miles. But I discovered that their Braj Mandala Parikrama is 32 miles, significantly less. But they stopped for a couple of days at each place, and they would give talks. And it's at one of those talks that our Prabhupada came and listened without going away. And Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati said, yes, I've marked him. He likes to hear. So 1933, what happened in 1933 that has any significance for you, Moksha? Prabhupada got initiated. Prabhupada got initiated, yeah. Well done, yeah. Yeah, Prabhupada got initiated in Allahabad. Very significant for us. Very significant. And in that year, Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati sent disciples to London. There was a lot of excitement. So Prabhupada gets initiated, and immediately he sees the thing that his Guru Maharaj really wants is a preaching center in London. So do you think that has anything to do with Prabhupada coming to London in 1969 in an attempt to please his Guru Maharaj? Because they came in 1933, 1934, and they did shake hands with various dignitaries. They even met the king, who was able to make his speech. And I'll let that go by you all. They met the king and Queen Mary, and there's pictures of them at Buckingham Palace. They met the Archbishop of Canterbury. And I met the Archbishop of Canterbury the other day, had a chat with him. It was last week, actually. And I was happy to meet the Archbishop of Canterbury. But then I read that, well, you know, Bon Maharaj did that in 1933. What happened? Nothing. The point is that to meet dignitaries is a certain type of influence. But to meet people that are going to take up the teachings of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, that's another type of very important and long-term influence. Both are there. They're not mutually exclusive. Writing a complicated book that the public can't understand, but which you need to pass on the lineage, is essential. Writing a book that everybody can read is essential. And there doesn't need to be a fight between them. Doing festivals and doing book distribution, there doesn't have to be a fight between the festival team and the book distributors over which is more important. And when Tribhuvanath Prabhu, God bless him, God has blessed him, asked Prabhupada the same question, he said, should I stop doing festivals and just do book distribution? Prabhupada said, no, everything, side by side. And when Prabhupada wrote instructions here as to how we should carry on Krishna consciousness in this country, he said everything side by side, and he named the different things. And if you read the letter that Bhaktivinoda Thakur wrote to his son, and if you read Prabhupada's letter to us, you will see a common spirit there. You bring in people of all ages, you bring in people of all levels of interest, you bring in people of all levels of practice, is that a word? Practice. And that's what you do. So he sent, and they were going to set up a preaching center in Kensington, a very nice part of the world. There was a king, again the king of Tripura, who seems to be a very confidential associate of Bhaktisiddhanta. The prince that was taught by him, he said, I will buy you land in South Kensington. And they were all set to build a temple in London, in Kensington, and it would have happened, except that in the year when the things were going to happen, you know, that was 1936, 1935, 36, Christmas 35. So he passed away. He passed away. And so that dream was never realized. So the London connection, Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati used to have a map of London in his room. And he used to meditate on that map, that one day there will be a temple in London. That's how strong his meditation was. So we have his desire for London and to the British. Prabhupada also had an individual desire. He wanted to satisfy his spiritual master and build a temple in London. But his individual desire, I think, just reading between the lines, was also that he really wanted a temple in Edinburgh, because his teachers were Scottish. And he was always asking about Edinburgh. And Tribhuvanath told me that one of the last things that Prabhupada said was, when he was in Vrindavan, is there a temple in Edinburgh? Is it open? Is that temple in Edinburgh open again? It was very important to have a temple in Edinburgh, at least for Prabhupada there. So, 1933, he also opened a big center in Bombay. Later on, of course, our Prabhupada, opened up a temple in the Juhu district. And what a temple that was. Moksha can tell you all the stories about that. But when Prabhupada one day went from his temple in Juhu to to the Gaudiya Math temple, he got back in the taxi, or got back in his, you know, his car. And on the way, he was, you know, he was quite concerned. He said, they started that temple in 1933. It is the same size, and they have the same people. The same people were there. 40 years later, same people were there. He said, they have not expanded in 40 years. So to Prabhupada, this was something that you take what your guru has given you, and you expand it. You develop it. You know, as Prabhupada said, with regard to Mayapur, he said, he made a joke. He said, I've given you the spiritual world. Now develop it. Oh, of course, it was a joke, because how can you develop the spiritual world? It's already fully there. But he wanted people to come. At this time, 1934, and I'm coming to the end now, they developed the yoga pit. The yoga pit was a place where Bhaktivinoda Thakur had already established a temple, but he wanted something that was, you know, nice and established. He established the place of Lord Chaitanya's birth, plus a Nrsingadev deity, plus a deity of Lord. It was known as Shiva Doba. The far corner of that territory is known as Shiva Doba. Lord Shiva is always worshipped as the Kshetrapal. Anyway, so they wanted to establish a beautiful temple, an Adbhuta Mandir, a wonderful temple. So in 1934, in January, they began that. And they discovered a deity which was a four-armed Vishnu form as they were building the foundations. And you go there today, and that deity is still worshipped on the altar. They will bring that deity out for you. And one archaeologist said that this deity was obviously worshipped at least 500-600 years ago. So this is in the very spot where Lord Chaitanya's family lived. So he took that to be an indication that this deity was none other than the family deity of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, Jagannath Mishra's deity. So then we come to illness and poor health and the passing away in early months of 1936. We have to see that on the Tirubhav, on the disappearance day of the spiritual master, we reflect on the many gifts that he's given. So I hope I've done that and shown how ISKCON is really a continuation of the Gaudiya mission. And yet it's an individual entity in and of itself. Sometimes when we go to Mayapur, the remaining members of the Gaudiya Math are keen to point out to us that actually, you know, the Acharya is Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati, and your Guru Maharaj, Prabhupada, was just one of his many disciples. So really, ISKCON is our movement. And we say, we offer you our respects. Prabhupada was keen that did not happen, so Prabhupada actually restricted us in many ways. And somehow or another, that message is not getting to the devotees of today. Either the individual sannyasis or the spiritual masters are not passing on the messages that came from Prabhupada, because Prabhupada said, do not go outside Krishna Balaram temple for classes, do not go to Radhakund, do not go to Shamakund, do not go to these various places, do not go to my Guru Maharaj's birthplace, you know, because if you do, they will try to claim that you are their followers. And of course, we did. We cast aside those instructions and we lost, you know, a lot of momentum. So we come now to 1936, and he passed away. He was very ill in Puri. He came to Calcutta, and at the end of his life, he called for Sridhar Maharaj to sing the Sri Rupa Manjari Pada. He liked that song. And a little while later, one devotee had been given to him to around the clock care. And this devotee asked him, because he was sleeping and he came to, and he said, Guru Maharaj, he asked him a question. He said, are you all right? And he said, what can I say? Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna. And he just chanted, and then he passed. And as he passed, all the clocks in the ashram stopped. We hear that quite some time when someone who's very much the person of the building, the clocks stopped. And the clocks stopped, not one clock, but all the clocks stopped. And in one sense, everybody stopped at that point. There was just an outpouring of grief. It was Calcutta, and they commissioned a special train. And this train stopped at every station from Calcutta to Navadvip. And out of the windows were hanging pictures of Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Prabhupada. And there was thousands of people. They had been sent the message by telegram. They'd came, they flocked. And they all came with flowers and diwa. They all came up to the train and made their offering of flowers to the pictures on the side of the train in which his body was. He got to Navadvip. They took his body in a car. Then they took his body on a boat and crossed the Ganga to his resting place, which was in between the rooms in the Chaitanya Mat and the temple there. Look, when he was finally placed in Samadhi, there were thousands of Muslims, and hundreds of them were weeping, and they all loved him, as well as the thousands and thousands of devotees. They all came to honor him. Such was his contributions, and such was the contributions of his mission, that everybody had gained something from his life. And they say that as you pass from this world, the people who will come to your bedside, or the people that will come to your funeral, are the people whose lives you have touched in some way. So I guess the message is that in our life, we should start, if we haven't already begun, touching people's life in such a way, in a permanent way, to help them. So on this day, we remember his contributions, and we remember his life. He wrote 108 essays and books. He preached through the printing press, something which had not been done. Something which had not been done with any great level. It's a unique contribution. He protected pure Vaishnavism, protected the teachings. He opened 64 temples. He was the first person to do these exhibitions that we've talked about, that brought many people, that attracted people to the message of Chaitanya. Knowing it is one thing, but attracting people and having them take it up is another. Keeping them attracted requires pastoral care, the Christians call it. You can bring someone to Krishna, but keeping them with Krishna requires a great level of care. So he opened 64 temples where people could come and see Krishna and have some. He went on the radio. He was the first person to do kirtan on the BBC, as it was. The India, all India BBC. He was the first acharya, first Vaishnava acharya, to research all four Vaishnava sampradayas and to help people to understand the teachings of all of them. He reintroduced Trudandi sannyas to the Gaudiya line. He gained great reputation as a debater, someone who was very convinced about his message, someone who was very learned about his message, and someone who could use his conviction to present a winning argument over many others. In our line of work, that's helpful. usually if a person argues for something. But there are arguments that are based on compassion going on today in every part of the world. People today at the United Nations are making arguments based on the fact that we need an extra few million over here to, you know, prevent the spread of one of the most deadly diseases that the world has ever seen, HIV and AIDS. Or we need a few more million for research into breast cancer, which is now affecting one out of every eight women in the Western world. So these are, you know, really things worth arguing for. But the arguing with an authority who has money is based on your desire to help people. So this is when we say that Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati used to argue with people. It was based on compassion to eliminate the disease of all diseases, and that is the bhava rog, the disease of material existence. So that we have him to thank for. And everything that you look at and you touch and you taste and you see and you learn and you enjoy as in your life as a devotee, we have to say, thank you, Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur Prabhupada. And this is what we do today on his Divine Appearance Day. Hare Krishna. Thank you very much for listening. And thank you to those who stayed. I have marked you. You like to hear. Srila Prabhupada ki jai. Shri Shri Radha Gokulananda ki jai. Sitaram Lakshman Hanuman ki. Si Si Gaura Nithai ki. Harinam Sankirtan ki jai. ISKCON movement ki jai.